Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Pei Bet Amud Aleph, second line down. Kufa, I'm Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi, Koma Kom Shne Mar Rabbi Yehuda, Ematai Ubameh B'Mishnatenu, Enu Elo Leferesh Divrei Chachamim. So we saw this memra from Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi yesterday, which is, anytime Rabbi Yehuda appears in a Mishnah and prefaces a statement with either Ematai Ubameh, and he's qualifying the statement of the Chachamim or whoever else is in that Mishnah, he's not coming to argue, but rather to explain, to give more detail, not in disagreement. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Ematai Lefaresh, Ubameh Lachlok. Rabbi Yochanan differentiates and says that when he uses the term Ematai, then it's a qualifier of the original statement and not a disagreement. Whereas Bameh is a disagreement that he is Chalek on the Tanakam or the Chachamim. Ve'ematai lefereshu? Is that really true when he uses the term ematai in the Mishnah he comes to explain? V'hatnan. We have a Mishnah in Masechet Sanhedrin. Ve'elhein apsulim. These are the individuals who are not allowed to give testimony. They are psulei edut. Hamesachek ve'gubia. Someone who plays dice. Malveh beribit. Someone who lends with interest. Mafrichei yonim. He raises pigeons, doves, visochari shviit, and those that transact or do commerce in peirot shviit. Am Rabbi Yehuda, ematai. So here you have a qualifier, ematai. Bizman shein lo umanut elohi. That's only when he has no occupation besides that. Avayesh lo umanut shelohi areze kasher. If he has an occupation besides these items, then he remains kasher le'edut. V'tani ala b'braita, and we have a braita that gives us more information about that Mishnah. It says, v'chachamim omrim, ben she'en lo umanut elohi, o ben she'esh lo umanut shelohi, or ze pasul. Does not matter whether he has an alternative means for making money, if he has another profession, or this is his only means of making money or his profession. In either case, he remains pasul. Gemara says, "Hahi de Rabbi Yehuda am Rabbi Tarfon hi." That Mishnah is not Rabbi Yehuda, the Rabbi Yehuda that we're speaking about here, but rather Rabbi Yehuda in the name of Rabbi Tarfon, which is the Tanya. We have a Braita that shows up in numerous places, but the focus is in Nazir, which is am Rabbi Yehuda mishum Rabbi Tarfon leolam ein echad mehem nazir. Neither of them is a nazir. The fish ein nizirut ela hafla'a, because nizirut must be explicit. It must be articulated. It must be certain. So there's a case where there are two individuals sitting there, and they see a person walking towards them. Some of them they don't necessarily know. Maybe they do know him. And the first one says, "I am a nazir." If that individual is a nazir, and the guy next to him says, "I'm a Nazir if he's not a Nazir." Both of them are, in a sense, betting on whether this guy is a Nazir. The outcome of the bet is that you will be a Nazir. Whoever wins the bet will be a Nazir. Over there, Rabbi Tarfon says it fails, and you are not a Nazir, even if you're right. Because you require hafla'ah, you require an articulation and an understanding of what you are saying. When you say it, you need to know that you are becoming a Nazir. You can't put the nizirut in on condition, and a condition where there's uncertainty about what's going to happen. And because of that, it says, Alma, given to Misvekele, since he is uncertain as to what he's speaking about, inazir ilo nazirhu, whether he will be a nazir or not a nazir, lo mishabid nafshei. He does not come to a gemirat adat. He doesn't come to a full-fledged conclusion. He doesn't undertake to become a nazir in that case. Hachanami. Came into lo yodo, ikani ilokani, so too over here, when we're talking about misachek bikubia, and they're playing with the dice, or they're playing games of chance, since he doesn't know whether he'll win or he won't win, lo gomer o makne. He's not gomer his dad, doesn't gomer at the dad, he doesn't give over the money in a full-fledged manner. So what you have here is a very interesting machloket. Machloket is centered in the Gemara and Sanhedrin, and that is, what is the problem with misachek bikubia? What is the problem with playing with dice or games of chance? So the Tanakama, and this is similar to the position of the Rabbanon that we find in the Braita, say the problem is something called asmachta lo kanya. Asmachta is where you are entering into a transaction or you're entering into a game where you're not certain as to the outcome or whether you're going to win or lose this game. These individuals, according to Rabbanon, there says, are gazlanim midivrehen. These are thieves, midrabanan, the asmachta lo kanya, umigza gazile. Since asmachta is not koneh, he's as if he's a gazlan, and therefore he loses his ability to testify. Loses his ability to testify because we see this is a person who is willing to do things that are wrong for money. They're willing to steal for money. They are willing to act inappropriately for money. Money speaks to them. And our fear is then, when it comes to Edut, that money will speak to them as well. We can no longer trust their testimony, because their testimony can be swayed by bribes, by monetary means. Just like over here, this individual is willing to, number one, lend with rebate, even though it's Asur Min HaTorah, because he wants to make money. He is willing to transact in Perot Shvi'it, even though the Torah says, L'achla v'lo l'schora, that you may eat them, you may not transact in them. Nevertheless, he's willing to violate that Isur Doraita in order to make money. And so too with all of these items. Sechek b'kubya being the one of game of chance. There too, the reason is that there's no real kinyan. The two parties enter into the game of chance, they're going to roll a die. And whenever the number comes out, they'll have bets on the number, and one of them will win. So when he enters the game, he puts his money into the game. His assumption when he goes into the game is that he's going to win. He's not going to lose. So then when he does lose, did he really put in his money with a full-fledged belief that it could go either way? No, he put in his money because he thought he was going to win. And by doing so, he didn't have what's called gemirat hadat. He didn't have a full understanding or a full grasp of the fact that he is granting all the rights of this money into the game. And then whoever takes the money takes it fair and square. So Gemara calls that a smachta sumech, that you rely on. You rely on the fact that you're going to win, and that's why you enter into the game. And by doing so, you don't give over your money full-heartedly. So because of that, when the other person wins and takes your money, they're considered to be gazlanim, as if you're a thief, because you took it, we'll call it, quote-unquote, against the will of the other individual. And that is what we call asmachta lo kanya. On the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda believes asmachta kanya. It does work here. That asmachta, when the person enters into this game of chance, he understands, as Rashi says over here, asmachta hu shenismacha dato shenatzchenu. Vato asmachta hu matne kanyo. Because of that, he enters into the game, assuming that he's going to win, and he gives it in a full-fledged manner. So then what is the problem, Mesachek b'kubya, according to Rabbi Yehuda? Lefi she'enu asukim b'yishuvo shel olam. These individuals are engaged in activities that are not productive, that do not improve the world. And because of that, kevan de makirim ubikim b'torach v'tzar b'nei adam, since they are not familiar with people's troubles, difficulties in making parnasah, because they're involved in activities that are not necessarily productive and do not involve heavy-duty work. So therefore, they're going to just be willy-nilly about these things or about money in general. So since that's the case, ena chasina chavrayim lefsidan mamon, they have no qualms about causing other people to lose money. They don't understand the human condition. And so because of that, they're precluded from testifying because we're afraid of their sincerity and whether we can really believe that they won't be swayed by other factors or by money. And because of that, they are left out. Whether it's the same requirement for someone who davens for the Amud on Rosh Hashanah and Yom HaKippurim, there the halacha is brought that those people have to know, they have to be regular people, they have to involve, they have have children, they have to have difficulty bringing up children, they have to have difficulty with parnosa. They should be like everybody else. So they, when they go to Davin, they represent the people and the difficulty of the human condition. And that's the proper person to represent you when they go up in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Not people who are not in need in any way and don't have any requests of Hashem and don't know those difficulties. The same thing here, this same requirement. What you have here is a major machloket about this concept called asmachta kanya and asmachta lo kanya. Whether when you enter into these games of chance or possibilities of winning and losing, do you grant a full-fledged kinyan or do you not grant a full-fledged kinyan? Machloket Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim. Over here we see that Rabbi Yehuda, in the name of Rabbi Tarfon, seems to subscribe to the position of the Chachamim as well. We saw this in the Gemara on Shabbat, on Daf Kuf Mem Tet. Over there the Gemara also says that that is a liba de Rabbi Yehuda amar Rabbi Tarfon. That was talking about the manot, the different size portions that they were dividing up at the table, and they put into the lots and see who got the bigger piece or the smaller piece. So over there again, whether it's Machlokes Kanya or not, Gemara there brings in Rabbi Yehuda Amar Tarfon as the position that says that it's Machlokes Lo Kanya. Now this has major implications to halacha. Tosafot over here is a very large Tosafot, does a decent job organizing the situation, but the question that is faced by many of the Rishonim, and what Tosafot is trying to address here is, when does a person feel that they are wholeheartedly giving over their money, and when do they feel that they're half-heartedly giving their money? The question is, how much control do you have? When you have tremendous control over the outcome, do you then say, I'm definitely giving in my money because I can control the outcome? Or is it the other way around, where I have absolutely no control over the situation? I recognize up front that this is a game of chance, and therefore I am going to full-heartedly give my money over because I know that I don't have any control over it. I know that these are other possibilities. I understand the game up front. So Tosafot discusses this. Rashi in Sanhedrin, Rashi in other places, has a position on this. The problem is that it doesn't work consistently. The Rabbeinu Tam brings up the opposite possibility of Rashi, and then the Reed defends Rashi's position because there are numerous cases in the Gemara that talk about Asmachta. Some places where Asmachta works, some places where Asmachta does not work. The first thing Tosafot says is the halacha is ki Rabbi Yehuda. We pass an halacha ki Rabbi Yehuda. Now, the Rambam doesn't necessarily agree. We'll see the Rambam in a second. But Tosafot says we pass like Rabbi Yehuda. And therefore, l'sachek b'kubya, if a person rolls dice and plays games of chance, it is not a problem of asmachta lokanya. You can do this. You can enter into such games. Now, the reason is because it's totally out of your control. When you know when you enter into a game of chance like that with a die, you might think that you can roll the dice better, but you really know in your heart of hearts that you have no control over this situation, and therefore when you enter the game with the understanding that you could lose or you could win, and you enter wholeheartedly in that manner. It's a good question. In regards to the stock market, one issue is that you might be buying something and you might be buying ownership. Buying ownership over something doesn't mean because it depreciates or appreciates, therefore you don't buy it. If you own a property, if you buy a house, it has the same thing. So if you believe through that, with regards to this stock market, that you're buying real ownership, which is the case, then it's different than a game of chance. In addition to that, osek bishuvo shel olam, right? There's value created through the investment in companies. That's for both parties. I mean, people invest in these companies because it benefits the liquidity and the ability to raise capital for companies. And therefore, he's not just doing things that are gambling and not doing something that has productivity or benefit to the yeshuv in general. I think there are other things that you could say as well, but those in a broad sense are why I would distinguish between investing in the stock market and these types of situations. So Tosafot over here brings other cases where we say Asmachta does work and Asmachta doesn't work. So for instance, they have a case in the Gemara in Bava Metzia where the Gemara talks about if you are a sharecropper and you are working the land, the contracts include in it that you have to work the land. The problem is that if you don't work the land, then both parties lose. You could say, I don't mind. But the Baal HaBayit says, I gave it to you as a sharecropper because I'm assuming I'm going to get my percentage out of the land. If you don't work the land, then I lose. So in the contract, it says that if you leave the land fallow, that you will pay a proper amount, the amount that the field should have produced, the potential of the field. There's also another contract where the person enters into the contract and says, if I don't play the field, if I don't work the field that year, I'll give you 1,000 zuz. So there the Gemara differentiates. In one case, the Gemara says it works, that it's not an asmachta, and therefore it's kanya. In the other case, the Gemara says it's asmachta and lo kanya. Gemara differentiates between these two cases. So Tosafot, in taking this up, explains the difference. In that case, both of them are within your control. To plant the land is within your control. And yet in one case we say it works, in one case we say it doesn't work. Why? So the difference underlies when it's in your control and there's a reasonable outcome. If you say, if I don't work the land, I'll pay you as if I had worked the land. In that case, a person's gomer dat, he wholeheartedly enters into the transaction because he believes that he will control the situation, he will plant it. And if he doesn't plant it, the penalty is severe, is something that is reasonable. The penalty is, basically, had he worked it. And that a person would accept and enters into wholeheartedly. When a person enters into a transaction and says, listen, if I don't work the land that year, I'm going to give you 1,000 shekel, 1,000 zuz, that transaction, when he enters into that, he's not really thinking he's not going to work the land. It is in his control, but what is the reason that he's saying, I'll pay you that much money if I don't do it? He's trying to engender trust in the other party. He wants the other party to believe him that he won't leave it fallow. So he exaggerates. He overstates the case. In that situation, he's not really entering into the transaction in order to have the possible outcome of him paying 1,000 shekels. He thinks it's never going to happen. And that's why he's doing it. He's only saying it to engender trust. And in that case, he is not koneh or makneh. He doesn't get into the transaction in a wholehearted way. And that will be considered to be an asmachta and lo kanyo. It doesn't work. So here we have, according to Tosafot, four different categories. Four different categories, which then we can test whether you'll have an asmachta. If it's completely out of your control, like games of chance, then we say there's no asmachta here because you know entering into the situation that you could lose, you could win, and it's not in your control. So you're not relying on the fact that you're going to win because you don't have any control over the situation. In that case, it's not an asmachta and you have a full-fledged, wholehearted kinyan. The other case is where it's totally in your control, where it's totally in your control and you're entering into a reasonable transaction. In those instances, that's also koneh because a person would enter into that with reasonable assumptions and knows that there's a possibility that they could lose. And in the gas case, again, it's not problematic. The two cases where we say asmachta lo kanya are, number one, a case for gazim, where he exaggerates. When he exaggerates or the penalty is not reasonable, we say he would never enter into a transaction like that in order to end up on the losing side of this. He must have thought, he must enter the transaction thinking that it could only go his way. And because of that, we assume that it's not considered to be a full-fledged kinyan. The other instance where we say that is, of course, where he's trying to engender trust. For instance, he pays back a third of the loan, and he says, if I don't pay you the rest of the money by such and such a date, then it's as if I didn't pay you anything, and the loan resets, and I owe you all the money again. So in that case, it's totally in his control to pay the money back. Nevertheless, he is only saying this to engender the trust of the other individual that he's going to pay the money. He's not doing this because he really thinks he's not going to pay it. And in that case, again, the kinyan is not a full-fledged kinyan because he never believes that he's going to actually lose the third of the money that he already repaid. He thinks that he's just going to pay back the other two-thirds. So in those instances, it's a smachta lo kanyo. The last thing that Tosafot notes over here, which is very important, he says that games of chance, you can only do this if you put the money there up front. If you put the money down, because that's gomer makne. But if you play games of chance ba'amana, on credit, it doesn't work. Because a person's only gomer makne when he puts the item down in front of him and he realizes that the money he's entering into the game will be lost. When he does it on credit, it doesn't work that way. And therefore, if he does it on credit, he says it's not chayav l'shalem if you enter such a game because there a person doesn't have gemirat hadat. Because there's no kinyan. There's no real kinyan. There's no activity that shows that you have a kinyan. That might be important in terms of gambling. If people get together to play a game of poker, if they just hand out chips and then play the game, and then afterwards everybody pays in their money, it might be problematic in terms of asmachta lo kanyo. It might be that people have to put their money down up front so that they understand what they can lose. It's important in a psychological sense as well. Not only for gemirat hadat, but that you really, when you play on credit, or the problem with credit is people don't realize the significance or the size or the amount that you're entering into. If you have to take the cash out and put it down up front, then it has a impact on the individual, and then if they decide to do it anyway, then you know they're gomer makne versus not. The Rambam, on the other hand, Rambam has a stira internally. The Rambam says that hamasachepik ubia is gezel midivrehem. Gezel midivrehem seems to indicate that he paskins like the chachamim here against Rabbi Yehuda. Yet in Hilchot Edut, he says that the problem with masachepik ubia is only when you have no other profession. But if you do have another profession, then it's not problematic, which seems to be that he paskins like Rabbi Yehuda. So the Rambam seems to go in both directions, both that it's gezel midivrehem and the fact that if you have another profession, then it's not a problem edut. That leads to some of the poskim to speak about the problems of gambling and what exactly are the conditions in order to gamble. The Shulchan Aruch himself says, Shekol omer im lo yeh lo gamar v'hiknesh or derito adayin sumechet shem yeh o shem lo yeh. Shulchan Aruch paskins that games of chance like the Rambam are problematic and asmachto lo kanyo. V'yesh omrim, the Ramah brings down, chalukim midinei asmachto. There are differences in asmachtot, and he quotes basically the layout of Tosafot. the differences that we laid out in when a person is willing to give in and not willing to give in, and the difference is whether the money is there up front versus if it's done on credit. And the big question that comes up today is with regards to the lottery. Can you play in the lottery, especially in Israel? When you play in the lottery in Israel, you buy a lottery ticket, and in buying the lottery ticket, you're playing a game of chance, a game of chance which you have no control over, and the money that you win is a pool of money from other people who play this game of chance. So if, atzmakta lokanya, when you receive the winnings from the lottery, you're taking winnings from something that is atzmakta lokanya. On the other hand, if you believe that it's atzmakta kanya, then you don't have a problem. So the Shtut Yubi Omer, the Avad Yosef says that you should not play. The Fizeb and Idon Didan, the Gabe Mifala Pais, to do with the lottery in Israel. Shazuchem Mekabel Skuma Ot Gadol Mina Mifal. He has a chance of winning a large amount of money. Tmurata Skuma Muachi Shilem, in exchange for the little amount that he wagers. Vaskum Nesach Mikol Mishtatfim Bapais. And they get the pool of money that they pay out from all those that pay in to the lottery. Yesh Bezem Mishum Kubya Vasur. That is an instance of gambling and is restricted. He says that playing the lottery in Israel is gezel midivrehem, and a problem of playing a game of chance where asmachta lokanya. Now, maskana dedina, he says, la'alocha, hasfardim ve'idut mizrach asur lahem lishtateif b'kniyat kartisei mifal apayis. Sfardim cannot participate because he paskins like the Rambam, and the Shulchan Aruch who say that it's a problem in these games of chance. Choshkein kartisei sport leminehem. Certainly, when they're gambling on sports games that are involved on issues on Shabbat, he says for sure there that you cannot participate in. If you participate, then you're actually encouraging people to do the wrong thing, to play the sports on Shabbat, or to be involved in these activities on Shabbat. He says that you probably should be asur. And whoever follows our way will be okay. Obviously, the Ramah, and he has ways to show that the Ashkenazim could participate in the lottery because of the Ramah and the Tosafot. But nevertheless, he says that he leans in favor of saying that it's problematic even for the Ashkenazim because of the issue of the incredible odds that are involved in the lottery, which is that it's so stacked against you that it's problematic that nobody would ever put in their money assuming those were the odds. On the other hand, those who argue on Ravad Yosef suggest that is exactly why someone gives in the money, because they understand the odds up front. They understand how bad the odds are up front, and therefore when they give in the money, yeah, they're going to win. But they basically know that it's a flyer. They're taking a flyer on the lottery ticket, they put the money in, assuming that they're not going to get it back. If they win, great. So that's why others believe, like the Tosafot, that there is Gmirat HaDat here, and that's why you can participate in the lottery. Now that's in the lottery, which is a more innocuous thing. When it gets to gambling and involved in gambling issues, then it's much more difficult, especially given the addictive nature of gambling and the difficulty that people have from separating themselves from it. People have to be very careful with these issues, both from a halakhic standpoint as well as the destructive nature of these types of activities. They have to also be careful about that. Right, the winner is the problem, not the loser. Yes, our Rambam brings that down. That misachek b'kubi abegoy. The Rambam paskins, like you're saying, misachek b'kubi abegoy embo isur gezel, v'yesh bo isur osek b'tvarim b'teilim. He says, you're right. There's no problem with gezel when you interact with the goy. Right. He says, it's a problem only because you isur b'tvarim b'teilim. Because you're not doing productive activities. You're doing things that have no value in the real sense. If you call it recreational, maybe you can justify it. But other than that, there's no productive nature to this type of gambling. So there won't be Isur Gezel in that case. It's Isur Gezel midivrehem. It's a Durabanan. The Ritvo actually says it's Isur Gezel midoraita. He says, why do they call it Isur Gezel midivrehem? It's because that's the way people think about it. People don't think of it as Gezel. So that's why they call it Isur Gezel midivrehem. But it's really an Isur doraita, the Ritvo says. It's a pretty strong stance of the Ritvo. But you're right, the Rambam himself differentiates between playing against a Jew and playing against a Goy, but in both cases he says it's problematic, one because of Gezel and one because of Isuk B'dvarim B'teilim. Alright, that's just a broad overview. I'll send out the Mekorot on Sachek B'biyah so you can look at it in more detail on your own. Alright, here we move on to the next parak. Ketzad Mishtatfim B'tchumim. How do you get together to be Mishtatef in a Eruvei Tchumim? Meniach et achavit. He brings the barrel. And the barrel here is because they stored all their fruits and their dry things in barrels. So he brings it here. V'omer, harzeh l'chol b'nei yirit. This is for anybody in my city. The Chol Mishe Yelech the Beit Avel or Beit Mishteh. Anybody who's going to the house of mourning is going to the Simcha, to the wedding. So here you have a Eruvei Tchumin. How do you lay out an Eruv Tchumin? So here a person takes out a big barrel, puts it out, and he's mizake the remainder of his city in this item. So now, V'chol Shekibel Alav Mibojo Mutar. Anybody who accepted this person's gift, quote-unquote, before the onset of Shabbat, is included in that Eruv. Mishitech Shach, anybody only joins after dark, Asur, Shem Me'arvin, Mishitech Shach. Eruv Tchumin must be in place before the onset of Shabbat, otherwise it's not effective. So if you accept it and you join it before Shabbat, then we're good. If you don't join it till after the beginning or the onset of Shabbat, then it doesn't help you. So here we have what's called Eruvei Tchumin and the ability to, for another person to grant you rights in their Eruv Tchumin. Rabbi Yosef, Ein Ma'arvim Ela Dvar Mitzvah. Rabbi Yosef, this is something we saw earlier in the Masechta, that you can only put out an Eruv Tchumin for a mitzvah. Ma'ika Mashmalon, what is he teaching us? Tanina. That's exactly what it says in our Mishnah. You can do it. The Chol Mi Sheyelech LeBeit HaAvel or LeBeit HaMishteh. The Mishnah gives examples of items that you can put out an Erev Tchumim for, and both of those are mitzvot. Why did it give examples of mitzvot? Because Erev Tchumim can only be done for mitzvot. That's what we saw earlier on in the Masechet Shabbat. That's the position of Beit Hillel. Beit Shammai says it's Asur LeGamre. Beit Hillel says that you have to change the manner in which you do Nichum Avilim. You have to say Shabbat Hil Min Achem and Nochama Krova Lavo. You have to change the approach, but it's not completely Asur. They dissuade you from doing it, but it's not completely Asur. Despite the fact that it's a Begia in Shabbat, or the spirit of Shabbat, nevertheless, the reality is that people are Menachem Avelim on Shabbat, and the person needs Nichum on Shabbat. But we change the nature of how we do it. Another possibility is that they're being ma'arei for Motzei Shabbat in order to pay a shiva call on Motzei Shabbat, which we've seen in the past with the Dvar Mitzvah, person is allowed to be Makshich ala Tchum. So now the Gemara says, Ma'udutema, had I just had our Mishnah, Orcha Demiltok Tani. The Mishnah is giving examples, but it's just giving examples of what people normally do. It's not definitive. It's not that that's the only way you can do it. You can do it for other reasons. It's just giving you the normal cases or examples. Kamash Malan. That, no, Rav Yosef says, the Mishnah is giving you the exact or definitive examples, which is only for Dvar Mitzvah, may you put out an Eruv Tchumin. You have to have the Eruv in place during the daytime. Shvamina, in Breira. You see from here that there is no Breira. You cannot retroactively have that decision made. Dim Yesh Breira, if there is an ability to retroactively decide where your Eruv is, Tiglei Milto Lamafreya, Dimido Yom Avenechale. Why don't we say retroactively that he would have picked this Eruv Mibojom, and that's what he wanted, and therefore he goes with that Eruv. Amar Rav Ashi, Hodiyu, Velo Hodiyu, Ktani. Rav Ashi says, how can you compare this to the normal case of Breira? In a normal case of Breira, what happens is you have both options in front of you. You have yet to decide between the two options. Later on, you make your decision. When you make your decision later on, what we say is, that was your decision all along. We say retroactively, that was if you decided that fact up front. And that's when Breira works. Breira works in an instance where I have the options in front of me, I need more information to make the decision, and once I have that information, retroactively, as if I had that decision all the way along. Over here, that's not what's happening. Over here, the person doesn't know about the other option till it's dark. He only finds out about the other option on Shabbat. So then when he finds out the other option, he says, oh, retroactively, I want to have that option. That's not the case. He wasn't aware of the option before Shabbat. You can only have something work retroactively if you had the information. And then you can say, I really want, or this is what I really wanted to happen. On the other hand, if you don't have the information, you can't say this is what I wanted or this is what I would have chosen because you didn't have that choice. You didn't have that option in front of you. And that's the difference between cases or regular case of Breira where we say it works versus this case over here, which doesn't even enter into the world of Breira because you don't have the information. You didn't know about the Eruv until Shabbat. That means you can't retroactively say, oh, now I want it. There's no retroactive. The moment you found out about it is the first moment where it could have possibly been your Eruv, and that's already on Shabbat. And that's how Rav Ashi distinguishes between the normal case of Breira and our Mishnah. Rav Ashi, Katan ben Shesh Yotzei Be'eruv Imo. A katan who is up to 6 years old goes out with the Eruv of his mother. He's subsumed, he's included in the Eruv of his mother. He does not have to have a separate Eruv because it's considered to be what we call the extension of his mother. It's the gufa dami. He's like her extension of her body. The other expressions like that in Gemara, which is ubar yerachimo, or ishtoki gufo. We have these concepts that people can be extensions of each other. Here, the child's extension of the mother up to the age of six. Meitve. Katan shetzarich li'imo yotzei be'iruv imo. The qualification the Braita says is, a katan who needs his mother goes out with his mother's eruv. She'ein tzarich li'imo, inu yotzei be'iruv imo. And if he doesn't need his mother, he doesn't go out with his mother's eruv. V'tzna nami gabi sukkah. By sukkah, we have the same qualification about whether a child is chayav in sukkah or not. Ki ayavna. Katan she'ein tzarich li'imo chayav b'sukkah. A katan who is not, who does not need his mother, is chayav in sukkah. It has to go into the sukkah. Now, chayav in sukkah is only 6 years old, 7 years old. What does that mean, chayav in sukkah? So Rashi says, mechanchinon lei midrabonon. That you have an obligation then to be mechanechim midrabanan. This is Rashi the Shitato. Rashi the Shitato, that the chiyuv of chinuch is on the parents and not on the child. So the parents are then obligated to ensure that the child goes into the sukkah, so in order that he learns to do the mitzvah. The threshold for that is whether he needs his mother or doesn't need his mother. And we ask on that, Vezu katan shein tzarich li'imo. What is the definition of a child that doesn't need his mother? So Amrei debei Rabbi Anai, koshin nifne ve'eni mo mikanachto. Anyone who goes to the bathroom and doesn't need his mother to clean up after him. Rabbi Shimon Lakish amar, koshin ne'ur ve'eno kore ima, or ima. Person, anybody who wakes up, and when he wakes up, he doesn't call his mother. Ima? Sakadatcho? Just calling you mommy when you wake up? Gedolim nami karu. Even older kids do that. When they wake up, they call mommy. Ela ema koshnir mishnato veino korei ema ema. Or doesn't call ema ema. Someone who wakes up and doesn't say it multiple times. As Rashi explains over here, dolo tzavach or dolo yanuach ad atyek likamei. Meaning that it's not just two times that he says it. It means that he is relentless in calling for his mother until she comes. Versus older kids or someone else who call for their mother. The mother doesn't respond, then they just let it go. So the difference being whether they insist on their mother coming and they persist in calling her until she comes or not. That's the definition of what's called tzarich li'imo and eino tzarich li'imo. So then the Gemara says, v'kama, what's that age? Kavar arba, kavar chamesh, 4 or 5 years old. Now 4 or 5, which one is it? Is it 4 or is it 5? The answer is it depends on the maturity of the child. I mean, 4 or 5 is the right range. The more mature the child is, then it'll be earlier in age. The less mature the child is, then the later in that range. But the range is 4 to 5. So how do we reconcile that with Ravasi's statement over here? Ravasi says the katan is tzarich li'imo, is called a 6 year old. Yet over here by sukkah we're saying katan tzarich li'imo is 4 or 5 years old. So how does Ravasi basically disagree with the Braita who lays out the definition of what is considered to be tzarich li'imo as being 4 or 5 versus the 6 that he mentions over here? Right, so here it seems to be the Gemara is giving a threshold that's saying it's around 4 or 5 years old is where we would expect it to happen. But Ravasi is saying that it's 6 years old. So why is he giving a different expected age where we're going to have this threshold? Now Tosfot does point out, we just said that you can only make an Eruv of the mitzvah. And then what's the shaychut of the katan to a mitzvah? Why are you allowed to make an Eruv for this katan? He's not involved in the mitzvah. His mother might be involved in the mitzvah. So he gives two answers. One is that the mother couldn't go unless the child came. If the child doesn't come, the mother can't go and the mother can't participate in the mitzvah. So then he becomes a part and parcel of the mitzvah because it's necessary for the mother to go. The other possibility, he says, inami ika mitzvah lechancho. It's a mitzvah to be mechanechem, which is interesting because Tosafot in general believes that the mitzvah of chinuch applies to the child themselves, not to the parent. It applies, the child himself is then obligated in the mitzvah, and that's the mitzvah of chinuch. That there's an obligation on the child. The parent has to facilitate it, but not necessarily that it's the mitzvah of the parent. So that's interesting over here. Tosafot, it's not clear, but it sounds over here like the parent is mechanech the child, and that is the mitzvah, which is a little different than Tosafot's approach in other places in the Gemara. So Gemara says, first answer to this stira, or what seeming stira between Ravasi and the Braita is, Amar Rav Yeshua, Braid Ravidi, Ki Amar Ravasi, Gagon Sh'irei V'alav Aviv, Litzafon, V'imo L'darom. There was competition here. The father put his Erev in one direction, the mother put it in the other direction. Da'afilu bar sheish, nami b'tzavta d'imei nechalei. That even up to 6 years old, the company of the mother is more comforting or more appealing to the child. Yes, you're right. He's not considered to be a child that's tzarich li'imo anymore, so he is independent of his mother. But here, he has his mother and his father. Each one of them put it out in a direction, and now you have to make a decision. Who does he draw after? Does he go with the mother or does he go with the father? The answer is he goes with the mother because up to the age of 6, his mother's company is considered to be more appealing to him. And that's what Rav Ashi is speaking about a different case entirely. It's not speaking about when tzarech limo, lo tzarech limo. It's speaking about this case where there's a necessity to decide between the father and the mother. There he says the mother still trumps up to the age of six. Meitave, is that really true? Is that explanation right? Katan shit tzarech limo yotzei be'eruv imo ad ben sheish. You have a braita that says explicitly, a katan utzarech limo yotzei be'eruv imo ad ben sheish. Until six. So, Tiyufta, Rav Yeshua bar Ravidi, Tiyufta. That's a big problem for Rav Yeshua bar Ravidi, because now his explanation doesn't hold water. Over here, we're talking about a case, the Braita says, that it's a Katan Shetzirich Limo, and Be'eruv Imo. It's talking about his mother's Eruv. His mother put out an Eruv, and Ad Ben Sheish, until six. Rav Yeshua says that when you reach the age of five already, meaning that's the way he explained the Braita before, the difference between Rav Asi and the bright over here is the fact that up till five, you can join his mother. But from five and up, then he can't join in his mother's Eruv, and he has to do his own Eruv. Yet over here, it says that you can all the way up to six, that he can join in his mother's Eruv. So that undermines that explanation of Rav Yeshua Breid Rav Idi. And that's why the Gemara says, Tiyufta on that. Gemara says, Levi Tavi Tiyufta Rav Asi. Why don't you say it's a problem for Rav Asi? Rav Asi says that until six, he can join into the Eruv. Yet, over here, the Braita says only Ad Ben Sheish, only until the age of six, but six is not included. So, I'm like, Rav Asi, Ad Bad Bichlal. No, I'll explain to you the difference. It's a difference on whether you say that the number is inclusive, or the number means up until. So, when they say Ad Ben Sheish, when they mean until six, it means inclusive of six. Ad Bichlal, including six. So they could come to a reconciliation that the difference between their understanding or the Braita's understanding is Braita really means ad bad bichlal, and therefore he can reconcile with that. So let's say that it's a problem for Rabbi Yanai and Reish Lakish. Rabbi Yanai and Reish Lakish just said in the Braita by Sukkah that four and five are the age. And now we have a Braita over here by Tzarech Limo, by Chumin, which says that it's ad ben sheish, lokasha. Ha de'ite avui b'mata, ad lo ite avui b'mata. Depends if his father's around or not. Is his father remaining in the sukkah? So by sukkah, where we know that his father is there because it's going to be in the sukkah, then at four and five already he's considered to be ein tzarech limo, and he'll go to the sukkah, he'll separate away from his mother. On the other hand, when we're talking about eruv, where father's not found in the city, he will go with his mother even up to the age of six. He'll stay with his mother because the alternative is staying alone. So the question is, what's the competition? If the competition is staying with dad, then he will, at four or five already, leave his mother and he's Eino Tzarech Limo. On the other hand, if the competition is staying alone, then he will go with his mother even up to the age of six, and that's how they'll reconcile. Now the truth is that Rabbi Yeshua Breid Rabbi Idik should have been able to use this answer as well. He should have been able to answer the same way that Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yanai answered. Rashi says the reason that Rabbi Yeshua lo matzah l'shnoi hochi is because he already made a distinction. He made a distinction between four and five and six and said that six applies when there's competition between the father and the mother. So that already makes it impossible for him to give the explanation of Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yanai over here, because he already gave definition to that statement of Rav Asi, and that's different than what's being said in the Braita or the way they're explaining the Braita. So because of that, he cannot give the explanation that they're giving and differentiate in this case. Because what it says, halacha is Rav Asi, hilchot Rav Asi, that until the age of six, we do consider the child to be Tzarech Limo, and his included or subsumed under his mother's Eruv. As opposed to Eruvei Chatzerot, or Shituf Mevaot, where we said there's a maximum of a Shtei Seudot, by Eruvei Tchumin, every person who is involved in Tchum needs Shtei Seudot per person. So over there, the family, each member of the family would require Shtei Seudot, and that's why it makes a difference. As opposed to by Chatzerot, you're right, you max out at Shtei Seudot, and it doesn't matter how many people you have after that. That's true by Eruvei Chatzerot, that's not true by Eruvei Tchumin. Okay, Tan Rabbanan. Me'ev Adam Eidei Bino Bito Aktanim, Eidei Abdo B'Shivchato Aktanim, Ben Ledatan, Ben Shalo Ledatan. First, you can put out an Eruv for his children who are minors, or for his servants, maidservants that are Knanim, whether they know about it or whether they don't know about it. I mean that he's able to do it, quote-unquote, against their will, because he is in control of them. Since they are minors, he can make the decision on their behalf, or by Evan and Shifcha Kananim, they are considered to be Yado, the extension of his body or extension of his hand, and therefore he can act on their behalf. Aval, Enu Me'arev, Lo Yadei Abdob Shifchato Ayivrim, he cannot do this for his Jewish maidservants and servants, Lo Yadei Beno Bito Agdolim, or those of age, Lo Yadei Ishto Elamidatam, or for his wife, unless they acquiesce. since they are now in control or they're on their own, therefore he doesn't have a right to override their will. And he has to get their acquiescence in order to put out an Eruv on their behalf. Tanya Yidach, we have another brighter. Lo yerev adam ha'yidei b'no b'to ha'gdolim. Ve'yadei ha'abdo b'shifato ha'ivrim. Ve'lo yadei ishto elemi da'atan. Again, this corroborates what we saw before, that you need their acknowledgement or acquiescence in order to put out the Eruv. Aval me'erev hu ha'yidei abdo b'shifato ha'gdolim. Ve'yadei b'no b'to ha'gdolim. Ben ha'datan ben shalo b'da'atan. Again, same thing that we saw before. You can do that against their will. Mipnei shiadan ki yado. Because they are considered to be extensions of him. They are just extremities of him, and therefore he can act on their behalf. V'kulan shi'irvu v'yirev alehen. If all these people that are mentioned here, if they put out an eruv shi'irvu v'yirev alehen rabban, yotzin b'shel rabban chutz min ha'isha b'nei shokhalu limchot. So then, all these individuals, he puts out an eruv for them, it's considered an eruv, and they go out with their rebbes or their adons eruv, chutz min ha'isha, except for the woman, because she can object. So in this case, if they put out an eruv for themselves, plus the adon, the baal, or the father puts out an eruv as well, we say that their eruv works, but only for the isha. For the others, it seems like the father or master's eruv works despite the fact that the others put out an eruv. But why should that be? Why should isha be singled out? It says isha maishna. Why is the isha, why is the woman different here? What about all these other parties, like the gdolim, and the eved, and shifcha ivrim? They also have independent ability to reject what the father or the master does. So how come over there we don't say also by them, that since they can reject it, that they're not sumech on that eruv? So Gemara says, Amarabo isha v'chod d'damila. When it says a woman, it doesn't mean just a woman, it means a woman, anybody in that category. That category is anybody who has the ability to reject or not acquiesce to the Eruv. Amamar, chutz mi'an isha, mipnei shechola limchot. Except for the woman, because she can reject it. Taima demalchi. That's only if she does reject it. Hastama nafka mibalo. It sounds like the default is that if her husband puts out an Eruv for her, that she goes or she can follow that. She doesn't have to opt in. She only has to opt out if she doesn't want it. She's automatically assumed to be a part of her husband's Eruv unless she opts out. Haktani reisha, but in the reisha it says elami daatan, that you have to, they have to get their acquiescence, which sounds like you need them to say my lav damri in, that they have to say yes. So the question is, what is the default status? Is the default status no and they have to opt in, or is the default status yes and they have to opt out? So from the latter half of the bright, it sounds like only if she's mocha, if she rejects it, does it not work? But if she didn't reject it, she would have been opted in on default. But the ratio of the mission says we need midatan. We need their acknowledgement or the acquiescence, which sounds like in order for it to work, they have to opt in. If they don't opt in, then they're not a part of this eruv. So which one is it? So Gemara says, look, my elo midatam dishtiku. Now the datam in the ratio of the Braita is dishtiku. They were silent. Silence is admission. Silence is acquiescence. So therefore, when they are silent, it's the equivalent of opting in. Afuke hache damre lo. To exclude the case where they say no. If they opt out, then it works. They're able to opt out. The Gemara says, V'ha'av chulam shirvu v'yerolehem rabban yotzim b'shel rabban v'stamahu. There it says that it's a case of stam. Tani chutz mishna delo nafke. Except for the woman who can't go out with that. Even in a case of stam. Sounds like from there that the woman isn't able to go out because she has the right to reject it. It's enough if she doesn't say anything. It's as if she rejected it. She doesn't join the Eruv unless she actively opts in. So Amarova came in Shirvu and the Chamikui Gadol Mizeh. Now that case is because the woman put out her own Eruv. She puts out her own Eruv, even though she didn't say anything, it's the equivalent of saying no. There's no greater objection to the other Eruv than putting out your own personal Eruv and turning going the other direction. And because of that, it's considered as if she's Mocha. So in all these individuals who have the right to object to the a rule of the father or the husband or the master, in that case, the default is opted in. If they say nothing, if they are silent, they're opted in. If they reject it and they say no, then it doesn't work. Then they're not a part of the Eruv. And if they put out another Eruv, then that's the equivalent of saying no, because that's showing that you do not want the Eruv of the other party, and that's the equivalent of saying no. Okay, Mishnah, Kamo Shiro. What is the shiur of Eruv Tchumin? Mazon shtei su'udot l'kol echad ve'echad. You need two su'udot for each party that is a member of this Eruv Tchumin. Mizono l'chol v'lo l'shabbat, divrei Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says a weekday meal, not a Shabbat meal. Rabbi Yehuda Meir l'shabbat v'lo l'chol. Rabbi Yehuda says it's a Shabbat meal, not a weekday meal. V'zeh mitkavin l'hakel. And they both are l'hakel. Meaning that Rabbi Yehuda believes on Shabbat you eat smaller meals because you're going to eat three meals. You have shalosh seudot on Shabbat, and therefore you'll consume less food per meal. As opposed to a weekday when you only have two meals, then their meals are larger. So Rabbi Yehuda says use the Shabbat meals, which are smaller meals. Rabbi Meir says the other way around, that's mezono lechol below the Shabbat, because on Shabbat the food is tastier, it's sweeter, it's more expensive, so a person eats more on Shabbat than he does on chol. And therefore we measure by your weekday meals and not your Shabbat meals. Even though you have more meals, you tend to consume more per meal on Shabbat. So that means the hakel. They're both hakel, assuming they're just trying to determine which one is the lesser of the two meals. Yochanan Bebrok Omer, Rabbi Yochanan Bemoka says, how do you determine what the size of these shtei sudot is? Says, mikar bepindion, a two sudot is from a loaf of bread that is purchased with a pundion. When, dalid sa'im besela, when you can purchase four sa'ah for the equivalent of a sela. So let's just need some quick math to work this out. A sela is four dinar. A dinar is six ma'ah, and every ma'ah is two pundion. That means for every sela, you have four dinar, so that's four, times six ma'ah, because a dinar is six ma'ah, is 24, plus every ma'ah is two pundion, means that there are 48 pundion per sela. That's in terms of the monetary expense. It says here, for a sela, you're going to purchase four sa'ah. So a sela means that you have 48 pundion, and that with that, you purchase four sa'ah. A sa'ah is equal to six kav. If you have four sa'ah, then you have 24 kav. So if I have 48 pundion by me, 24 kav, that means that every pundion buys me a half a kav. And that's what Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka says over here. When you buy a loaf of bread for a pundion, that's the size of shtei sudot. So what is the shtei sudot over here? That's a kikar pundion or half a kav. A half a kav is the measure of a loaf of bread that's made out of half a kav. That is your shtei sudot. So then Rabbi Shimon Omer, shtei adot l'kikar mishlosh l'kav. Rabbi Shimon has a different measure. And Rabbi Shimon believes that from a whole kav, you get three loaves of bread. Each one of those loaves of bread is the equivalent of three seudot. So you have, in a kav, you have nine seudot. He says, if you take one loaf of bread, you get three seudot. Then Rabbi Shimon says, of that loaf of bread, shtei adot l'kikar, mishalosh l'kav. Two-thirds of that loaf of bread is the two seudot that you're looking for. So if I take it in relationship to the kav, that means that if a kav produces three loaves of bread, each one equal to three seudot, and then I'm taking two-thirds of one of those loaves, that means that it's two-thirds times a third, which is two-ninths of a kav. So Rabbi Shimon believes that two-ninths of a kav is shtei seudot, whereas Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka says half a kav gives you the shtei seudot. So that's the machloket here as to the size that gets you the shtei seudot that you need. So now the Mishnah continues and says, chetzia the beit hamnuga, v'chetzi chetzia the v'solet gvia. This has to do with achalochot of tuma. When one enters into a house that has nigaim on it, you become tamei. The Torah tells us that if you then eat in that house, then your begadim are also tameim. So the Gemara dashes on that pasuk that it doesn't literally mean you have to eat, but if you stay in there, the amount of time it takes to eat, the amount we're going to say now, then your begadim become tamei. So if you just simply enter and leave the house, then you are tamei, but your begadim remain tarim. It's chetzia. Chetzia means half. Half of what we said before, which is, if before you needed shtei seudot, now you only need one seuda. The amount that would be the equivalent of one seuda. Then chetzi chetzia, then half a seuda is lipsolet agvia. That is the amount of tamei food that if you consume it makes you tamei. We saw this in the beginning of the Gemara in Shabbat. That was the gzerot of the chachamim that a person who consumes tamei food makes himself tamei. Min haTorah, tamei food cannot make an adam tamei. They over there made it tamei because of the problems of truma and eating it together with truma and other issues that they were goes there. But what is the amount of food you must consume in order to make your body tamei? That is chetzi chetzia or half a seuda, half of a half. Tomorrow is daf, we'll have another half of that, which is a quarter of a seuda will end up being the amount for tumat ochlim. So again, we'll do all those measures tomorrow. Now the Gemara says, v'kama mazon shtei seudot. What is this mazon shtei seudot? Meaning basically translated into our terms in our day. This is a Mishnaic terms. This is talking about in the time in Eretz Yisrael. Here you're dealing with people in Bavel. They want to know, give me the equivalent today in Bavel. So he says, Amar Yehuda Marav, tarte rifta ichraito. It's two loaves of bread of the ichraita. Rashi says these are cowboys, two loaves of bread that the cowboys take out to eat. The Mesorat HaShas brings that it could be Kikarer Shochlim HaRoim. These are the shepherd's bread, shepherd's loaf. Probably come the word Ikar. Ikar means a farmer or someone out in the fields. So that's one possibility. Rav Adar Bar Abba Amar Taita Rifta Nar Papita. Two loaves of bread from this location of Namar Papita. So there, they translated into their day what the equivalent two loaves of bread would be for Shtei Seudot. Amalei Rav Yosef, the Rav Yosef Breit de Rabba. So Rav Yosef says to Rav Yosef, the son of Rabba, remember, Rav Yosef is a Talmud Chaver. Rabba and Rav Yosef disagree in many places, but Rav Yosef, Rabba is really Rav Yosef's Rebbe at some points, or definitely it sits a little bit higher than him, but they are Chaverim. We know that from the story at the end of the Gemara in Brachot. Avuch Keman. Your father, Rabba, Keman Svirle, who did he hold like? Rav Meir Svirle. He held like Rabbi Meir. For the reason that David said before, Ananami can Rabbi Meir Svirle. I also like Rabbi Meir. Deek Rabbi Yehuda Kashi Ad Amri Inche. Because if you hold like Rabbi Yehuda, then I have a problem with the colloquialism, which is Rav Chod B'Sima Shchiach. That there's always room for dessert. That's the way the context that's used in Megillah, which is that when you have sweet foods or spiced foods, you're able to eat more of them, and there's always room for it. So therefore on Shabbat, and this is what you said, David, we definitely hold like Rabbi Meir, which is that we eat more food on Shabbat. Despite the fact that we eat more meals, we also eat more food because the food is sweeter, tastier, and because of those influences, we tend to eat more food despite the fact that we're going to eat more meals. And so therefore, to be the kula would be Rabbi Meir, which is to use weekday meals as the measure. Yochanan ben Brocha Amar, Tana ukrovim divrayim liot shavim. We have a braita that says that their positions are very close together. That of Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha and Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha, we just said before, it's a half a kav. And Rabbi Shimon says it's 2/9 of a kav. That doesn't sound close at all. Yet we have a braita here who's saying that it's close. The Gemara says, mi dami. Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha is the case, the arba sudat of the kabo. You get 4 meals per kav. A half a kav gives you 2 meals. A full kav gives you 4 meals. The Rabbi Shimon said that a kav gives you 3 loaves of bread, with each loaf having 3 meals. That means for a kav, he has 9 seudot, the kabo. He has 9 meals per kav. They're nowhere near each other. One's saying 4 per kav, 4 meals per kav, and the other one's saying 9 meals per kav. So Amar Rav Chisda, tzei mehem shlish lechenvani. He says you have to pay for the work that the storekeeper or the baker does. So in that case, what Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha is saying is that really within a kav, you have 6 meals. You have 6 meals per kav, but you only get to keep of those 6 meals, 4 of them. 2 of those meals, you have to pay off the baker who's taking care of you. So you pay him off 2 of those meals, and then you have the residual, which is the 4 meals that you get. So when you start with a kav, you get 6 meals. Only 4 of those will remain with you, and that's why he's using that measure. But that still doesn't help you. That only gets you to 6 meals per kav, versus Rabbi Shimon's 9 meals per kav. That's the case. Vakati, the martisha, for Rabbi Shimon, it's 9. Or the mar shit, and for Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha, it's 6 meals. Elikin idach, Rav Chisda. We have another thing, Rabbi Yisrael Damar, say, man, mechsa the chenvani. Chenvani gets 50%. So that would mean in this case, you would, for a kav, according to Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha, you would start out with, you get 8 meals. 4 of them would go to the baker, and 4 of them would go to you. So there you end up with 8. And the Gemara says, Vakati the Mar Teisha, for Rabbi Shimon, you have 9 meals per kav, Lamar, and according to Rabbi Yochanan Raka, you have tamne. You have 8. Like Gemara says, exactly what it meant. Hainu de kamri, krovim de reim, liot shavim. They're not exactly equal, but they're very close. You don't pay him money. You hand him a kav, and his payment is that he keeps 4 of the sudot, he gives you 4 of the sudot. That's his profit. In exchange for his work, he takes a portion of the outcome. So they're not paying him money. But the Gemara now wants to know, what about Kashi Rav Chisda, Rav Chisda? Rav Chisda just gave you 2 different methods of payment. One is where the baker gets a third, and one is where the baker gets a half. Which one's right? So Kashi, Adukoye Balbayit Tzibe, Adaloye Balbayit Tzibe. Depends on the transaction. If the person who's giving him gives him the wood for the fire to bake the bread, then the transaction ends up that he only gets a third of the kav. Whereas if he doesn't give the wood and the baker has to supply the wood, then the baker gets half to compensate him for putting the wood as well. Okay, so we'll continue with these measurements in tomorrow's daf.